Hello, my name is Cassie St. Clair and welcome to the Blue Plaque Pod. My guest today is Matt Kane, who is a writer, broadcaster and commentator on LGBTQ plus issues. He was the culture editor at Channel 4, the first culture editor, no less. He has also been the editor-in-chief of Attitude magazine and an ambassador for Manchester Pride. He's the author of The Madonna of Bolton, The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle, and most recently, Becoming Ted. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Cassia.
I would first of all like you to introduce yourself in the style of a blue plaque, since we're all about blue plaques here. Can you describe where this plaque is? It's got to be somewhere really significant to you, you know, birthplace, childhood home, or first place of work. So where is your plaque?
Oh, that's so difficult, actually. Sorry to flounder at the first question, only because there's several places that were important to me. Possibly, I'm quite lucky in that my family lived in the same home for 29 years. And you mentioned my book, The Madonna of Bolton, and this was loosely based on my own story. It's about a gay child growing up in the working class north in the 80s, looking to Madonna to be his spirit guide to help him through the challenges of growing up gay at that time. So I was living in this house then, and as that was my breakthrough novel, I would probably say my childhood home. I mean, the funny thing is, I've recently got to a point where I've lived outside my hometown for longer than I was ever in it. And I recently moved house in London after being in one area for 20 years. But in terms of somewhere that defined me, I would probably pick my childhood home in Bradshaw, Bolton. I can give you the address.
Feel no need to dox yourself. You can describe it. But I think, you know, hometowns, whether or not you spend actually all that long living there, they have such a hold over you. Okay, so we've got the location and we obviously know your name. But how, I mean, part of the challenge of the blue plaque is brevity. You've got so little space. So how would you describe yourself in just a few words?
Well, another writer once described me as camp, clever and common. and that kind of defines me because, you know, if you are common and northern and working class, people often underestimate your intelligence. They don't think you're clever. And if you are camp, often now, these days, it's great that people often love a camp gay man, but they sometimes think you're all about light relief and they don't expect any emotional depth or intelligence again. So this has been the kind of challenge with my books, to express my authentic voice in equal with the balance of all these different parts. Right. I've slightly dodged your question. In terms of how I would describe myself on a blue plaque, I don't think you could have camp, clever and common on the...
It would be great. It would be fabulous. but maybe a bit, maybe a little bit obscure and opaque. Maybe you need to give the people who walk past your plaque a bit more help than that.
Yeah, well, I would say novelist. I mean, it's funny. I don't know whether... I've never really thought of myself as a journalist, you know, even though I have done it a lot. It was always about what I wanted to say. My best journalism has always been personal journalism. It explores the same themes as my books. I'd probably say writer. And the reason I mentioned camp, clever and common is when you do have a mainstream publishing deal, you have all these meetings about your brand values, which I'm putting in inverted commas. It's what you stand for and what people understand of you. Northerner, gay, would absolutely be up there, which is why I'd be sidetracked with the camp, clever and common. But even you couldn't really write... Could you put northern, gay, northern? I mean, I don't even know how you would get that on a blue plaque.
I mean, maybe you could say commentator. Maybe you could be camp, clever, common commentator. Just a final question about this this hypothetical plaque of yours, or maybe the plaque that they're going to have in the future. Would it be an official blue one or an official looking blue one, or would it be something a bit more decorative and unofficial?
So it's interesting. There was a debate a few years ago about the lack of queer people from history recognised by blue plaques. And there was talk about, I can't actually remember how the debate was resolved in the end, but there was talk about pink plaques, rainbow plaques. I like all that. Being gay is a big part of my identity. I'm proud to identify as a gay writer. I think you want the official, really, don't you? We don't want some kind of thing on the side. You know, you want the proper official recognition.
You want the heft of the blue plaque.
Yes. Gravitas. It's been denied me all my life. I wanted it there.
Perfect. Well, that's your plaque sorted out. And now we're going to meet the person that you've chosen. Their plaque is in London. It's at number 2 Warrington Crescent in Maida Vale. And the plaque that you've chosen is for Alan Turing. And it's an official blue plaque. And it says Alan Turing, 1912 to 1954, codebreaker and pioneer of computer science, was born here. So a little bit about Alan Turing. He, according to the English Heritage, is one of those rare people who can justifiably be said to have changed the way in which we live. How many people can we say that about? He was the founder of computer science, a British mathematician and logician who made major contributions to fields including mathematics, cryptanalysis, logic, philosophy, cognitive science, and artificial intelligence. He also created machines that helped crack the Enigma code. He was also something of an enigma himself. He was pretty openly gay at a time and in contexts where there wasn't much acceptance. He was also a very keen runner and very sporty. He continued to use running as a way in which to relieve stress, once telling a friend that the only way I can get out of my mind is by running hard. Can I ask, first of all, why you chose this plaque? What was it that drew you to this plaque and to Turing?
I just always really connected with him, and I felt a real sense of rage at the way his story was overlooked until relatively recently. I've always been interested in queer history. I'm proud to be a patron of LGBT History Month. But the interesting thing is, so many of our stories have been erased. And one of the reasons is we had to live in secret. We had to destroy evidence. If we didn't destroy evidence, often our descendants did, to protect memories. And this has meant that people can wipe us from the historical record. Or not so much wipe us, but wipe our sexuality. You know, so with Alan Turing, for example, people would deny how significant his sexuality was for a long time. Or they'll point to the occasional relationship with a woman, with people, and say, oh, see, they weren't gay. And, you know, ignoring the complexities of what goes on in your head and your heart as a gay man when you're trying to be normal and you're trying to prove to yourself that you can be normal and, you know, you're going through all that. And I like to explore all of that in my novels. And one of the reasons I write, actually, is because there are these gaps in the historical record, and I think fiction can fill them in. You know, I like to have older gay characters with backstories that I can explore, you know, the persecution and some of the awful things that happened to us. And I do like contrasting those awful experiences with how much more accepting the present is. I just think it's a tragedy with Alan Turing that he never lived to see a more enlightened time. He's basically a gay hero. We don't have many of them from the past. And because of what happens towards the end of his life, which I know you're going to come on to, it's impossible for anybody now to, now that all that is known, to pretend he was anything other than gay. Yeah, so I chose him for all those reasons. Also, a couple of other things. He lived the last part of his life in Manchester, which is my home city, the setting for lots of my novels. And actually, funnily enough, in your introduction, which was brilliant, and thank you very much, you missed out the latest one, which is called One Love, which is set almost entirely in Manchester. And there are scenes in Sackville Gardens, which is just off Canal Street in the gay village, where there is a statue to Alan Turing on a bench in the park. And so this is in the gay village where he is recognised. So again, there's another point of connection there. And also the plaque, which is in London in Warrington Crescent. When I went to Cambridge from the Northwest, I used to visit one of my best friends in London in the holidays, and she lived on Warrington Crescent. So I'd go there as a kind of shy northern boy feeling overawed by how glamorous it was. And I mean, talk about imposter syndrome, you know, does it even go there? And I didn't know all the details of his story, but I would see that plaque on Warrington Crescent, which was my entry point into London. So that was a very long answer. I'm sorry, but
no, that's perfect. I love that there is this moment of connection. And I'm also sorry for missing out your most recent book. I thought I'd got it in, but good on you for correcting my mistake and making sure the latest title is in there.
Yes, and thank you. And yeah, it's, you know, I mention the novels because I do like going into the persecution of the past. I do think it's important that we know what gay men went through. And the other thing about gay history is we are one of the few minority communities who don't have at least one parent from the same minority automatically. It's just very unusual. So we very rarely get any sense of our cultural heritage or history handed down by queer elders in the family or in the your little micro society when you're growing up. It's for all these reasons that I feel a really strong connection to Alan Turing and his story.
That's such an interesting point, that the last one that you made. It's something that I've never considered, but I suppose it gives people like Turing even greater weight. You know, you can look back at people who are commemorated, and that gives a sense of history, like a much more deeper connection to see people who have been commemorated and the achievements that they've made, and that gives that sense of, like you say, of passing down that you don't otherwise get.
I think he's somebody, he's a historical figure that they can't take away from us, and that we can be so proud of. Even the way, you know, what happened, which set in motion the end of his life, which we'll talk about. You know, I love the fact that he was sex positive. You know, he liked anonymous casual sex. Who's to say that if he were alive today, when loving relationships are possible for gay men and recognised in the eyes of the law, he may have felt differently. But, you know, those kind of cruising, picking up men in cottages, as they're called, public toilets, it was all we had for a long time. So yes, some people are squeamish about it, but it is a part of our history that we can't deny. And it does open up the whole area of rights and the way that we were viewed by society. So Alan Turing's story even tells us about this part of our history. He's just so important for us to know about as gay men, and so important for wider society to know about, I think.
Well, I think that was a very good sort of link into the next kind of section. Essentially, I'm going to pick out three key moments or kind of turning points in Turing's life, and then I'm going to ask you to do the same. So the three key moments that I picked out, firstly, his development of a computing machine. So, you know, we've already talked about a little bit about his time at Cambridge. He's studied mathematics at King's College and was offered a fellowship there. And his work there led him to publish a paper in 1936 called On Computable Numbers. And this was later recognised as the theoretical basis for today's computers. And it's been argued that without his work, computers as we know them now would not exist. He later returned after the war and was recruited to the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington in London, where he was tasked essentially with creating an electronic computer. And he designed the Automatic Computing Engine, ACE. After that, he went to work at the Royal Society Computing Machine Laboratory at the University of Manchester. He also became fascinated by the idea of artificial intelligence and designed the Turing test as a way of testing whether a computer is really thinking. The second turning point, I think, is the development of the machine that would crack the Enigma code, which is work that he did in the Second World War. So war breaks out in September 1939, and he goes to the code-breaking department at Bletchley Park in Milton Keynes. The Nazis were at the time using an Enigma machine to scramble their messages to prevent them from being decoded by the Allies. And together with fellow mathematicians, Turing designed an electromechanical code-breaking machine called the Bomb, Bomb with an E at the end, rather sassy name, I like it. Apparently the original you know, the original kind of model for that name was a Polish word that I've seen two different interpretations. Some people say it's just Polish for bomb, and then someone else said that it's Polish for a type of ice cream. Bomb is either ice cream or, you know, just bomb.
Well,
boom.
Also, Cassia, if I can just quickly butt in for a second, I'm pretty sure that I remember in the film The Imitation Game, which was fantastic, they changed history to make it that the name of the machine was Christopher, the boy he'd been in love with at school, which was a nice touch. But unfortunately, the reality is possibly the Polish word for bomb, or we don't quite know.
Or the Polish word for ice cream. Yeah. You know, maybe there's a connection. Yeah. Anyway, he designed the bomb in late 1939 and into the spring of 1940. And by 1942, the cryptanalysis at Bletchley were decoding around 39,000 messages each month, and later up to 84,000 each month. And it's thought that their work, the work done at Bletchley Park, shortened the war by 2 years and saved countless lives. And Turing was given an OBE in recognition of his work at the end of the war. The third moment that I wanted to kind of pick up on was his prosecution and therapy, quote unquote. So he was elected as a fellow of the Royal Society in 1951, but just the following year, March 1952, he was convicted of gross indecency, you know, essentially homosexuality, which was a crime in Britain at that time. And he was sentenced to 12 months of hormone therapy, which essentially is sort of chemical castration. His criminal record meant that he could no longer work for government communication headquarters, GCHQ. He spent the rest of his life in Manchester studying artificial life, and he was discovered dead in 1954 in his bed, poisoned by cyanide. And this is sometimes thought to have been suicide, you know, attributed to the hormone treatment he received, although there is some doubt over whether it really was suicide. He had a laboratory next door to his room, and so some people have argued that maybe it was accidental. And there'd also been a year between his last treatment and his death, so there is some doubt over that. We know that he treated his hormone therapy, quote unquote, with, you know, a fair amount of equanimity, and he sort of joked about it with friends. But what a way to end a life of such incredible service. So those are my three moments.
Actually, the interesting thing is, I've talked about the connections I feel with Alan Turing, but actually when it comes to his work, it's such a different area to mine. I'm completely in awe of what he did, and it's not actually anything I know that much about. Certainly not to refute your analysis of which are the key moments that were important. I would actually agree absolutely with the first two. The only thing, and I also agree with the third, I do agree with all three of yours. I would say about the way that he died, there is some debate around whether it was suicide or not. But if you read the biography by Andrew Hodges, he has spoken to a lot of people who knew him, who said he had talked about ending his life, but he'd also talked about setting it up to make it look accidental for the benefit of his mother. And even though it was a year after he'd ended his hormone therapy, which again, people use as evidence for maybe that wasn't part of the reason, we also know, and we know from the biography, that he started a course of psychotherapy. And having lived with a degree of pride about his sexuality and not hid it, you know, he was very open, as you said. He suddenly was instilled with another wave of shame around this time. And as I understand it from the biography, he started psychotherapy because he wanted some kind of cure. But when he realized there was going to be no chance of that, he felt trapped and lonely. And I think they are factors that we need to consider. But I don't think I would disagree with your analysis of the key points at all.
I feel quite chuffed. We've already spoken a little bit about your connection with the plaque itself and the place and the fact that it was a place that you came to when you were at university. Is the plaque somewhere that you have, you know, or would make a pilgrimage to and would advise other people to do the same?
Well, funnily enough, even though I said at the beginning of our chat that I feel if there was ever to be one for me, it would be my childhood home. I think if you think about Alan Turing and what made him brilliant, I don't think it lies in that childhood home. I think it's, I think he was quite self-invented. When he moved away, you know, Cambridge was an awakening for him as it was for me. Manchester, you know, we know that there's an amazing gay scene, queer scene in Manchester now and has been for a long time. There was an underground scene in those days in the 50s. You know, so I imagine there was a degree of finding his people when he moved to Manchester. So I'm not sure I would recommend a pilgrimage there. I would probably recommend a pilgrimage to the statue that is in Sackville Garden in the gay village. And when you go, so I've been and I love leaving copies of my book in key locations. I've done it with all my books. And they all have key scenes set in Manchester, but the new one, One Love, the majority of it is set in Manchester. And actually, the two lead characters meet at Manchester University. There's another connection there, but I have been to that statue in Sackville Gardens and left copies of my novels for people to find that are signed with a little dedication in there, because I feel such a connection to him. And he inspired me to write these older queer characters with backstories that I explore, that open up queer history for readers. I would probably recommend that people go on a pilgrimage to Sackville Gardens, if you don't mind.
No, I love that. And I, because I think there is a tension between these very polite little plaques and sometimes the messiness and the messy realities of people's lives. And which is sort of a nice way of leading me on to my next question, which is, what do you think Turing himself would make of the way that he's been commemorated? And if I put the same question to him, do you think he'd send people towards the plaque and would be more proud of the plaque and his childhood home? Or, you know, do you think he'd have a different take on how he should be commemorated, you know, down to the wording? Maybe he'd want some reflection in the wording of the way in which he was badly treated by the establishment towards the end of his life.
These are really good questions. I love this format. It's so good the way it makes us
That's exactly what I want you to say.
I'm coming to this subject from the perspective of a proud gay man. I think we know that he was interested in gay rights. At one point in his life, he went to Norway to observe the advances in this area. I think if he lived now, he would be a very proud gay man. I don't think... obviously, the way that he ended his life ended was horrendous. I don't think he'd be consumed by anger. I don't think he would want the way his life ended to be commemorated. I think he would want the pride he felt at being a gay man, or the pride he would have felt if he'd lived longer. I think he would want the word gay in the very brief wording, as we've said, on the plaque. I think he would. I think he'd direct people to the gay village. I think he'd direct people to that statue as I've done. I mean, it may be completely fanciful, and obviously I'm coming to it from one particular perspective, but I really think he would have got over the shame that he was made to feel and reverted to his instinct, which was pride, and he would have directed people to that statue.
Well, that feels like a really nice way to leave him, actually. It's a kind of a sunny evening at the moment, and it's quite nice to imagine him wandering through the garden towards that statue and maybe being lucky enough to find a signed copy of your book there.
You know what, you've actually reminded me, and I feel really inspired again talking about his story with you. I'm going to get a copy of One Love, I'm going to take it, and I'm going to leave it on that bench in Sackville Gardens.
Perfect. You should write an inscription to him as well.
I will do.
Oh, fantastic. That's lovely. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you so much for thinking so deeply about this question and the questions that I've asked you, and about Alan Turing himself and what his life means to you. That's exactly what I wanted this podcast to be about. And I think those moments of connection between people today and people of the past are just really special and they're to be celebrated.
You've literally just defined why I write my novels as well as why you're doing this podcast. So the whole thing has been my pleasure. I promise it's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Blue Plaque Pod. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, leave a positive rating and review, and share this episode far and wide with people you think might enjoy it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Blue Plaque Pod. I'm on Instagram as @CassiaWrites and on Twitter as @CassiaSinclair. This episode was hosted by me, Cassia Sinclair, editing and audio production by Rob Burney at Made by DBM. The theme tune is Dawning Sprite by Lincoln Davis. Coming up in season one, we've got a Latter-day Dandy discussing Beau Brummell, Val McDermid on the woman once described as the crime writer's crime writer, and a news broadcaster known for his very good dogs discussing the troubling legacy of an early mountaineer.